From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, we'll talk about some top stories in the news with Marcus Bertone, plus Bay Area comedian Dennis Gaxiola, and country and bluegrass singer Rita Hosking with music from her acclaimed album, Come Sunrise. First, Sacramento school teachers recently agreed to concessions, but the city school district still faces big challenges. Today, we'll talk about those concessions and challenges. We'll start our discussion with the superintendent of Sacramento City Unified Schools District, Jonathan Raymond. Welcome back to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Nice to be here.
Well, we'll talk about the concessions in a minute, but first, where does the district budget stand now? Are you in a better place than you were, let's say, a month or two ago?
Well, we are from the standpoint of, you know, our budget is balanced and we have submitted it on to the state as required by the end of June. And certainly the recent concessions and agreements which we've reached with our teachers have helped. Now, we had a balanced budget before that, but what this has enabled us to do is to keep our class sizes in the K-3 area low and to also bring back and restore the vast majority of our counselors. So that's helped us.
If the budget was balanced before the concessions, why seek the concessions?
Well, so we can make sure that we keep a lot of our great teachers and our great counselors, and that's why it was important. I mean, we have to balance either way, and we were prepared to do it by making reductions, which would have increased our class sizes as well as would have eliminated the vast majority of our counselors at our high schools. These were tough choices that we had to make, but that's the state of where we are in public education today in California.
The current contract was due to expire in 2011, and earlier this year, the teachers' union said they didn't expect any negotiations on a contract before then. What did you say, if anything, to change that?
Again, you know, we went through a conversation. I mean, part of it was I'm new. And getting to know each other, developing a relationship, and that's a process that takes time. And I'm pleased to say we were able to accomplish. Nobody gets everything they want, that's why it's a negotiation. But we were able to reach an agreement that I think is good for our community. It's good for our schools, and it's good for our employees.
Jonathan Raymond, superintendent of Sacramento City Unified Schools District. We've been trying for some time now to have a Sacramento City Teachers Association official on Insight, but we haven't been able to schedule a date yet. But we remain committed to including the union's perspective and insight, and as soon as we can schedule an official, we will. Let's bring into the conversation Rachel Minnick, who's a parent of students at Phoebe Hearst Elementary School, which is in the Sacramento City Unified Schools District. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
As a parent of students, I guess you've been watching what's been going on. The district has had tough budget challenges, as have many districts in California. The district and the union, the main union, came to an agreement. What do you make of all this?
I think as a parent, I'm pleased that the union was willing to make some concessions to protect class sizes. My youngest is 8 years old, so she'll be going into third grade. So she would be one of the kids that would be affected the larger class sizes. So I was very concerned about that. And I was just pleased to see that they were on board with a lot of the economic realities that the rest of us are facing in the world. You know, I'm paying more for my health benefits. I'm furloughed a little bit in my hours. So I appreciated that they were willing to take on some of that load as well and share some of the pain.
When you say you're furloughed, are you a state worker?
I'm not a state worker. I work for a nonprofit, but we are state funded. So we had to make some adjustments to our workforce in order to accommodate the work and continue to serve the clients.
Jonathan Raymond, what were the main deals struck between your administration and the Teachers Association?
Several, Jeffrey. First, the teachers have agreed to take the equivalent of 3 days in salary reduction a year for 2 years.
So which that's basically a furlough.
That's basically a furlough, the equivalent of a furlough. But it's not a furlough, and that's good news because it means we're not decreasing the number of instructional days during the school year. Many districts have gone to that, but we think it was really important.
So the days will still be worked then?
They're still going to work. That's correct. So we're not going to reduce the calendar. The academic year will stay the same. Which is important. They've also made some adjustments to health insurance, which we had a grand jury report earlier this spring, which highlighted our long-term health liability. And so there are a number of things through restructuring of prescription drugs and looking at some of the out-of-area costs, as well as a monthly contribution the teachers will be making toward funding that long-term health liability are very important. And one that's also important is the changing of our professional development time and turning that into ongoing common planning, K-12, which is an opportunity for teachers to get together and collaborate. That's now going to be throughout the school district, K-12, which is very important for us.
The concessions were aimed at reducing layoffs of teachers and other certificated staff. Still, I guess the district has lost teachers.
We have lost some, yes, because our funding overall has been continually reduced. Many of the categorical funds, these are the special dollars for state and federal programs, are being reduced, and there are positions. Again, 90% of our budget is personnel. So when the funding goes down, you know, we have to make corresponding reductions.
Now, there's a political aspect to the layoffs issue, and that is that layoffs in school districts, certainly in Sacramento, are governed by seniority rules that have been bargained between the administration and unions. And what that tends to mean, as I understand, is that newer teachers to the district, which often means newer teachers, period, are the first to be laid off if there are layoffs. Has that been the case in the Sacramento City Schools District?
Like other school districts, that has been the case. And that's a challenge that we have to deal with and we have to face. There's certain ways we can work with that. And this year we have skipped math, science, and special education teachers. That's an area that we're always hiring, even in this downtime. Those are always hard to staff positions. And so we are, through a provision called skipping, you know, we can work with that. But that impact is felt here as it is in other school districts.
Rachel Minnick, parent of students in the Sacramento City Schools District, what do you think about seniority and layoffs? The teachers' union argues that more experienced teachers presumably have more value because, they're more experienced. They also tend to cost more because they've been in the system longer. If the slate could be wiped clean, how would you approach the issue of layoffs and seniority?
I'd love to see a really reliable evaluation tool so that we keep the best of the best, and we really pay them a premium because they really are the most important people in the community, I think, outside of parents. They are really important. So I would love to see that. And just to give an example, when my daughter was a kindergartner, she was kind of a victim of some of the hiring practices. Her kindergarten teacher was a newer teacher. And a few months, maybe a few weeks into the school district year, they had to reevaluate the number of students and the positions. And so my daughter's kindergarten teacher actually was laid off. I don't know where she went. I don't know all the specifics because it's a personnel issue, but she was replaced by a longer term teacher about 2 weeks into my daughter's first year of public school. And I picked her up and she said, "Mommy, my teacher's going away." And I said, "Oh, I don't think that's true. Maybe she's just taking a vacation. She's going to a wedding." No, she really did lose her job. And this teacher came in and taught and then during winter break decided to retire. So when my daughter came back from winter break, the teacher was gone. And so that was this really interesting revolving door. And it just had to do with somebody that had seniority but got moved around because of the number of students at different schools. So it was very difficult and very emotional for us.
Jonathan Raymond, superintendent, if there were no seniority rules, how would you handle layoffs of teachers? Presumably, if you were able to lay off without regard to seniority, you could lay off fewer teachers if you laid off more experienced teachers who make more money.
I think the way to look at it, Jeffrey, is and Rachel pointed it out, is do we have the tools that enable us to determine, you know, who are the most effective teachers. And I would say we don't. And that's an area that we need to start to do a lot of work in. And that's an area where we need to work together with our teachers, with our principals, you know, with all of our educators to find out those kind of tools which enable us to really determine, you know, which teachers are enabling our students to learn the most and the fastest and can connect with our kids. And there's a lot of work that's occurring around the country, you know, much of it funded through foundation and other philanthropic dollars. And that's work that I think we need to start to pay attention to and come together around and all of us collaboratively work together to see what can happen. But right now, you know, the law is the law and so seniority governs and that's the law that, you know, we live by.
Speaking of the law, Senator Daryl Steinberg, the Senate President Pro Tem in the California legislature, has authored a bill that would amend the seniority law so that teacher layoffs were spread more evenly across a district because they tend to happen in lower performing schools, which for one reason or another tend to have younger teachers. Do you agree with that bill, which, you know, could become law?
It's something that we're taking a look at to see what the impact is. I want to look at that. I think it also the other part of that is, you know, why are we concentrating our newer, younger teachers in our lowest performing schools? And that's something we can do something about as a school district. And so at the very front end, you know, we need to take a look at how we're distributing our teachers, where we're hiring and who we're putting in. And, you know, we're working on that right now in Sacramento with our six superintendent priority schools, trying to get our best leadership, our best teachers, the best opportunities for kids in some of our most challenging schools.
Rachel Minnick, are your kids aware of all of the politics and the tough money situation at their schools? Do you talk about it with them?
I think my kids are totally worn out on the discussion because my husband and I spend a lot of time talking about this. My kids go to a really wonderful school, and it's a magnet school where kids are at or above grade level. There's parent involvement. It's a wonderful school, but I don't know that it's a great representation of every school in our district, and I wish I could say that that was the case. So I don't know that my kids really know what it's like to go to a different type of environment or a different type of school. I went to those schools, so I know, but I don't think that my kids know.
Finally, Jonathan Raymond, let's just quickly touch on two related issues. The California Department of Education recently released an updated and expanded list of California schools on the fiscal early warning list, and Sacramento City Schools remains on the list. And in fact, almost every Sacramento County School District is on the list, as are some others in surrounding counties. Is anything going to happen soon at the department level with the city schools district? Is there going to be any action taken by either the County Board of Education or the State Department of Education?
I think the issue, Jeffrey, is one of finding some stability in funding. You know, that's one of the crises in public education right now, which is why I think confidence is really shaken in the institution, which is a bad thing for everybody. It's difficult to manage when you don't know what your funding is going to be. You know, tell us it's going up, tell us it's going down, tell us it's staying at the same spot, and it's a lot easier to manage too. But with uncertainty, with lack of clarity, with this really great unknown, it's really challenging. And what makes it really difficult in this profession is, because we're an organization of people, is, you know, keeping people motivated to do the work. You know, as I say, teachers and principals can't have a bad day. That doesn't mean that they don't feel well. But what it means is when you're in that classroom with 25 or 35 kids, you know, you have to be on. And the great majority of the adults in our system, I'm really proud of, because, you know, they don't have a bad day. You know, they do what's right and they do what's needed for kids.
And finally, you've asked your board to create a new executive position at the City Schools District, a chief accountability officer. Is this the time to add another manager to a system that's laying off people?
So we're not adding another position. In fact, we're reducing the cabinet level positions from 8 positions down to 7. We've decreased our central administration by close to $6 million. You know, dozens of positions at the Cerna Center have been eliminated. It's really one of saying, you know what, we need to change the way we do business. If we want the same outcomes, you keep the same structure. You want different outcomes, you got to change the structure and you got to change personnel. We're aligning around our new strategic plan. It's our vision and it's our roadmap for moving the district forward, and these positions align with that. It's about moving schools forward. As Rachel said, we have a number of schools in our district that do a wonderful job. They, too, can do better. It's a question of holding our schools accountable for continuously improving and moving up that developmental sequence.
Again, we've been trying for some time now to have a Sacramento City Teachers Association official on Insight. We haven't been able to schedule a date yet, but we continue to work on that. In the meantime, Jonathan Raymond, superintendent of Sacramento City Unified Schools District, thanks for joining us, along with Rachel Minnick, who's a parent of students at Phoebe Hearst Elementary School in Sacramento City Schools. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can stream Insight live or later at capradio.org/insight. Today on Talk of the Nation, NPR's Political Junkie with the political news of the week and a look at the implications of California's Proposition 14, the top two open primary. That and more on Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. The first Wednesday of the month, Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone joins us to talk about some top stories in the news and in sports. Marcus, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, any thoughts about Sacramento City Schools? As we talked about earlier in the program, the teachers union agreed to some contract concessions, so things are moving forward for another year. Fewer layoffs.
Right. Yeah, I see you've had as much luck getting a hold of the teachers union as I have. They are not. They don't make themselves available to speak publicly, which is problematic because the union has had so much power over the district for the last decade. And the fact that they hide from public view and choose not to comment on very serious issues is very problematic, and it kind of shows what Jonathan Raymond is up against. He's been an interesting figure in Sacramento in that he came from North Carolina in a state where he doesn't have to, you know, superintendents don't have to worry about teachers' unions, and came here basically to ground zero for union power. And obviously, you know, he's not a career educator, which makes him interesting in that he has a different perspective, a more well-rounded perspective. He, a lot of people don't know it, but he ran for political office in his home state of Massachusetts as a Republican, and he ran for Congress against Barney Frank and didn't prevail, but has taken a circuitous path to Sacramento and finds himself now trying to fix some seriously broken schools and doing it against a really tough union, a union that has beaten other superintendents before. And the fact that he was able to get some concessions, I think, is significant given what he's up against.
Let's talk about Mayor Kevin Johnson. He suffered, I guess might be the right word to use, his most obvious defeat when he lost a vote 7-2 on the city council. The city council said, no, we're not going to ask the city attorney to draft a strong mayor measure for the November ballot. And this was ended up being late at night. And the mayor basically went across the city council and said what he didn't like about them. And in your column, soon after, the headline was Sacramento Mayor's Worst Enemy is the Man in the Mirror. Why do you think the mayor responded the way he did? Because he still needs to work with the city council. Why take them to task?
It's the way he is, Jeffrey. And the interesting thing for me was that I've had that type of a conversation with him before where I was on the receiving end, and a number of people have. But typically, Kevin Johnson doesn't show that side of himself publicly. The image of Kevin Johnson is, you know, I mean, he's famous, he's rich, he was an NBA All-Star, elite athlete. Shakes hands with a lot of people. Just saw him in a parade riding on this past weekend. Has in many respects is the perfect mayor for Sacramento in that, you know, he's one vote on the council, but he's promoting the city, which is always a good thing. But it's the interpersonal relationships where he struggles because Kevin Johnson, throughout his life, has been a poster child. He was the kid who came out of the rough streets of Oak Park, became a star at Sacramento High School, was a legend at Cal, was an NBA. And I think people underestimate how great of an athlete he was. But for injuries, he would probably be in the Basketball Hall of Fame today. And then he returns to he goes to New York. He was a successful NBA analyst for NBC. He gives that up, returns to his hometown to take over failing schools and engages in development in underserved areas. It's a wonderful story, and from a distance it looks very compelling, until you have to deal with the guy one on one, and then you run into that attitude that he showed everybody. He is not used to having people tell him no. In fact, the point I made in the column was that the only time before this that he'd ever been denied anything was by Michael Jordan in the NBA Finals. So he doesn't respond well to it, to say the least, which is fine if you're a rich person, but not so much if you're the mayor and you have to actually deal with these people.
And yet, like an elite athlete, he always seems to have another pass, another dunk to make in the last second of the game. And two attorneys, Leon Randolph and Clark Kelso, have drafted a measure for the ballot on the strong mayor. So he basically, I guess, went around the city attorney and said, look, council members, I've got a draft for you. Does this have a chance, do you think, of going anywhere?
Here's the thing with Kevin Johnson. I never want to say never with him. Because he is capable of a lot. And when the game is persuading the city council, we're not exactly talking about stalwart, very courageous people here. He needs three votes. So can he get three votes? Yeah, it's possible. It seems very unlikely. And just the fact that he went this route, Clark Kelso obviously is very well known in this area. He always seems to be able to reach out to elite, successful people and get them to do a tremendous amount of work for him for free. It's an amazing gift. And he goes through these people who are more than willing to volunteer on his behalf because from a distance, his story seems so compelling. What ends up happening is these folks tend to get a load of him and then they walk away not quite as enthusiastic as when they approached him. So the bottom line here, though, is that all that aside, he needs to get three votes. Where he's going to find them is anybody's guess, since he just lambasted pretty much all but poor old Robbie Waters, who's leaving the council anyway. So it's an interesting situation for him to be in.
Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. He joins us the first Wednesday of each month. In the latest field poll, the two major party candidates for California governor are statistically tied. So I guess maybe one thing we could draw from that is that large amounts of name recognition, as in Jerry Brown, equals large amounts of money, as in Meg Whitman. But, despite California's Democratic tendency, it also has a tendency to elect Republicans as governor.
And I think that's exactly what the Brown forces are afraid of. And they've tried everything to discredit Meg Whitman, and let's be honest. I mean, Meg Whitman has done a pretty good job herself of discrediting herself at times. not to be unkind, but it does. You look at the system, and you think, is this the best that we can do? Where you have basically a super, super, super rich person, and you have a guy who, I'm 47 years old, and he was the governor when I was in the sixth grade.
Wow.
So, 1974, that was a long time ago. And yet here we are in fact, we just had a writer at the Bee who had a very long career, and he came to the Bee when Jerry Brown was coming in, and he's leaving the Bee when Jerry Brown is coming in. So it's kind of comical in that sense. But I think the poll probably speaks to, I don't know that either people can sift the difference between the two, or really are very enthusiastic about either one. And that's kind of where we are in California right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the baseball All-Star game. Washington Nationals rookie pitcher Steven Strasburg was left out, and he says he didn't deserve to play in the game because he hasn't been in the major leagues long enough. And he said pretty good numbers, but he hasn't played many games, right. But he's also a sensation. Would you have put him in the game?
No, absolutely not. And I've had this argument for weeks now with friends of mine, and particularly one friend who lives in Washington. And there has been a just the hyperbole around this kid has just been like nothing I've ever seen before, and he really is. And again, I get an argument, and I can't get too my high horse about this too much because I do work for ESPN as well. But ESPN and the media based on the East Coast have just been banging the drum on this kid and making him seem like he is the second coming, up to and including the day of his major league debut, having a clock in the lower right-hand corner of the screen counting down the minutes until he threw his first pitch, which is just preposterous. He doesn't deserve to be in the All-Star game. He's pitched very well against very bad teams. Let's have him really show it before you actually put him in the All-Star game. But I think the reason that we're even having that discussion is because some very big media outlets have been pushing the cause.
And finally, the World Cup. In your pre-tournament bracket, you had both the U.S. and England making the semifinals. But you did correctly predict the Netherlands beating Brazil in the quarterfinals, which is pretty good, and the Netherlands making it to the final against Spain, which could happen if Spain beats Germany today in the second semifinal. Do you really think Spain has a chance of beating Germany, who've scored 8 goals in the last 2 games?
I do. I do think that they have the combination of a stout defense and a creative players to be able to control the midfield and guard against the German counterattack. Typically, I'm very anti-Germany. And I mean, I love German film and German chocolate, you know, but not so much German football. But this team, I have to say, has been a joy to watch. They've been creative, bold, and just very artistic. So if Germany makes the final, I'm not going to be crushed. I do think, though, that Spain has the team. I think it's their time. And if Spain and Holland do play in the final, it would be exciting in the sense that you'd have two teams that have never won it before. Whereas Germany, obviously, is like the Duke of the World Cup. Obviously, Brazil has won it many times. But Spain has never even reached a final before, which is amazing. I definitely, in my bracket, I had too much faith in Team USA and in England and not enough faith in Germany. But my final is still there to be had.
People who don't really watch the World Cup, if you ask them in the future about this year's World Cup, they'll go, oh, that's the one with all the bad officiating. Is that a fair snapshot summary of this World Cup?
Yeah, the World Cup has made the NBA look good, frankly. And frankly, it's their refusal to use modern technology to clean up some of these egregious calls that have been made. There's goal line technology that's used in the National Hockey League where basically a buzzer sounds when the ball crosses the plane. And England was robbed of a goal in their round of 16 match against Germany, which was just, and it really ruined the game at that point. If they had been able to tie 2-2, look, they might have still lost, but we'll never know. Mexico, Argentina was awarded a goal against Mexico. He was clearly offsides. If you had instant replay in that situation, that would clean that up. And the worst part about FIFA, the governing body of world soccer, is that they won't even address the issue honestly, and they don't allow their they don't have any sort of peer review afterwards. In Major League Baseball and the NFL and the NBA, officials are constantly evaluating their performances. Not so in world soccer, and it's to the detriment of the sport.
Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. His column appears most Wednesdays and Sundays in the paper's Our Region section, and he's an Insight the first Wednesday of each month. Marcus Bertone, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, comedian Dennis Gaxiola. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's more about our guests and topics at capradio.org/insight. Bay Area comedian Dennis Gaxiola is coming to town. He's done a lot of TV with some big names, and tonight headlines a show in Sacramento. It's the weekly comedy night at Luna's Cafe, and he joins us by phone. Dennis Gaxiola, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well. It says in your MySpace page, I have nothing but love for all my friends from the U.S. Air Force. What's your connection to the Air Force?
I served 20 years with the U.S. Air Force.
20 years. That's extensive service. When did you do that?
I served from 85 to 2005. I joined when I was six.
Right. And what rank did you reach?
I retired as a tech sergeant. I had the two careers going on, so it kind of made it impossible to get promoted too high while I was doing comedy. So I had a blast while I was serving, though.
So you were a comic sergeant?
Well, I made fun of everybody. I was probably the most irreverent guy in there. So yeah, I had a blast. You know, I had different jobs, but I had a blast.
And where did you serve in the Air Force?
19 of my 20 years right here in Northern California, 11 in Sacramento at McClellan, then over in Sunnyvale for 5 years, and then my 1 year in Korea, and the last 4 years right here in Fairfield, Travis Air Force Base.
I see. My guest is, my guest is Dennis Gaxiola, comedian, who headlines tonight at Comedy Night at Luna's Cafe in Sacramento. I read that you're the son of a preacher. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I'm a PK.
Meaning what?
Well, that's what they call PK. Preacher's kids, they call them PKs.
And how does that affect you in your life today?
Well, I have my personal relationship with Christ, which I think is important. But I grew up with a real cool preacher because he was a thug first. So he wasn't real preachy. He was like, hey, man, you know, you got to live your life right. Love people, treat them with respect. So, yeah, I think I grew up with a pretty good balance in life.
Yeah. Let's listen to a clip of you. This was you doing your act. I think it was at a church last September, and you're talking about Mexicans in the Bible. And before the clip starts, you talk about a certain character called Jesus in the Bible, and here's how it continues.
There's a lot of Mexicans in the Bible. They don't even teach this on Sunday. There's a lot of Mexicans in the Bible. Moses was Mexican. Undeniably Mexican. Come on, who else get a bunch of illegals across the river away from my people? That's my people. He went up into the mountains and came down with riding on rocks. That's a cholo. He was tagging. King David, Mexican. Only a 5-foot Mexican could look at an 8-footer and go, I can take him.
Do you ever get into trouble from people for, you know, using ethnic backgrounds as a source of humor?
Well, every blue moon, it's usually from somebody that's real overly compassionate. But generally speaking, I told the line perfectly, making fun of everybody equally. And I base all of that off of my family. So usually my jokes are coming, and someone says, well, why would you say that? And I go, well, my nephew. You know, I have a Jewish brother-in-law, a black brother-in-law, the Puerto Rican sister-in-law, and my wife is Filipino. So we've got the United Nations. So generally speaking, most of my comedy comes from somebody in my family.
There was, in the past in comedy, there was a strong tradition of ethnic humor, but that went out of fashion because it seemed like it was demeaning to people.
I do a bit about that right now where you got to know the line. There is good humor in our cultural and ethnic differences, so long as there's no malice in the joke. You know, if it's malicious, it's not funny. But if you know the line of the group you're working with, you can have good fun.
You know,
if I do a country western bar, I'm not going to do any Dale Earnhardt jokes.
Sure. You performed at the Apollo Theater, the famous Apollo Theater in 1999. Tell us about that. What was that like?
I was literally shaking like a leaf as I walked through the hallways to see the legendary performers that had been there. And watching the show the night before, one of my friends was booed off the stage. at that taping. So the next day when I went in to tape, I was quite nervous. But you could be the worst performer in the world, the worst, especially singer. I always notice this. You could be the worst singer in the world, but if you sing a church song, they'll let you finish. So I started off with a joke about my dad being a preacher, and that endeared me to them, and I was able to survive and finish with a standing ovation. So it was probably one of the highlights of my career.
You've done TV or toured with quite a lot of well-known guys like Jamie Foxx, Paul Rodriguez, Martin Lawrence. What's your favorite memory of all that kind of work?
Touring with Paul for a couple of years has been incredible, because before George Lopez and Carlos Mencia and Gabriel Iglesias were stars, Paul was kind of carrying the Hispanic comedy torch by himself. So being able just to hang out with him and see the regular side of Paul for a couple of years, that has been a highlight. Doing the Jamie Foxx special for Comedy Central, it was called Laugh-A-Palooza. That was incredible because the audiences were just incredible in Atlanta. So, I mean, they've all been different experiences. Chicago, I shot that in May, and it'll air with Martin Lawrence. It'll air in October on Starz Network. It was kind of a... It was surreal, the number of comedians they had there that were, veteran comics, and they just pulled really strong lineups together. I mean, all the way back from Jimmy Walker to Sandra Bernhardt to guys at my level. So it was just an incredible show. So they've all been different, unique experiences, incredible experiences.
Dennis Gaxiola, he's a comedian from the Bay Area. He headlines tonight at Comedy Night at Luna's Cafe in Sacramento. Dennis Gaxiola, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Sacramento is where I got my start in comedy, so it'd be good to see some old friends come out.
Well, no doubt you will. Thanks again, Dennis.
Thank you for having me.
Bye. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, country and bluegrass singer Rita Hosking. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's been a good year for country bluegrass musician Rita Hosking. Her latest album, Come Sunrise, was nominated for Best Country Album in the 2010 Independent Music Awards. She's from Shasta County and lives in Davis. This Friday, Rita plays a house party in Sacramento. She and her band, Cousin Jack, joined us in January. No one in the band is called Jack, so I asked her to explain the name.
Cousin Jack is the name for a Cornish immigrant, or Cornish, which were usually miners, and my great-grandfather came from Cornwall, and I was always told that I was connected to the Cousin Jacks. And the title was supposed to come from the clannish nature of the Cornish. When they arrived at the mines, they'd say, well, do you have a job for me, Cousin Jack, too?
I was just going to ask if your great-grandfather was a miner, because that's what a lot of the people in Cornwall did and why they came out west.
That's correct. He ended up in Grass Valley at Empire Mines.
Yeah, that's why they eat a lot of Cornish pasties in Grass Valley, Nevada City, don't they?
And that's what I grew up on.
But you were originally from Shasta County?
Yes. Between Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen, there's a mountain called Hatchet Mountain, and that's where I grew up.
And how did you get into music?
Well, there was an old-time band called the Mountaineers where I grew up, and they were mostly older mountain folks who got together and played jug band music. And our school cook, Pauline, decided to get some girls together and start a bit of an apprentice band. And so she played piano by ear. I played the washboard. And we got together and we played old-time tunes and country music. And that was when I was about 14 and 15. Yeah.
My guest, Rita Hosking, and she's here with her quartet, which is called collectively Rita Hosking and Cousin Jack. Rita's new album is called Come Sunrise. Let's listen to a clip from the album. This song is called Precious Little.
Though my mountain's far away, the room here's my despair. I got precious little, come pull up a chair. Like that time back in 32, packed up on the road, Daddy.
Precious Little from the album Come Sunrise. Rita, how do you write your songs?
Well, a lot of them are inspired by home and history. Many times words just come to me in choruses and they develop into a song. In fact, I think for that song, I was swinging in a swing on a front porch of a cabin up in Ontario after I'd talked to an older gentleman about the tractors that he restores for a long afternoon.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how we all have precious little, we all have stories inside to tell.
Well, you and the band have brought in your instruments to play for us, and you're going to do the title track from the album, Come Sunrise, right?
That's correct. That's a song that I wrote for my kids, and I wrote that in a tent, camping in the rain during an Emmylou Harris concert at a festival. I was comforting my youngest daughter, who was having a hard time.
Well,
so it's a song about hope.
Well, let's just say hello to the other musicians before we hear them playing. One of them is Sean Feeder. Sean, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
What do you play?
I play the banjo and the dobro in this band.
And you spend a lot of time with Rita.
Yes, I am married to Rita.
How long have you and Rita been playing together?
Well, we started playing music together about 7 years ago.
Is that how you met?
No, I was a musician in another band a long time ago, and she was the housemate of one of the bandmates.
But we were drumming before that. He taught me how to drum.
Yeah.
I was one of his students.
Sean, what kind of band was that you were playing in before?
Kind of world beat, eclectic band.
Also with us is Bill Dakin. Bill, welcome.
Hello.
What do you play?
Upright bass, mostly, and some guitar.
And is this the kind of music you've been playing for a long time?
Generally, yes. I have. Somehow I came to just love old-time country music and bluegrass and old-time traditional music, and so this speaks to my heart, and I love playing it.
And rounding out Rita Hosking and Cousin Jack is Andy Lentz. Andy, welcome.
Thank you.
And you play?
I play the fiddle.
What's your background musically?
So I started off, I was a classically trained Suzuki, in the schools back in Minnesota, and then in middle school got into, Irish and Scottish music, and then in college, bluegrass and country. So, transitioned out of the classical world a bit, but yeah.
Well, very nice. Let's hear the song then, Come Sunrise, performed in our studio by Rita Hosking and Cousin Jack.
Strength to carry on.
That's beautiful. Rita Hosking and the other three members of her quartet called Cousin Jack playing the song Come Sunrise in our studio. There's a version of that song also on Rita's self-titled album, obviously called Come Sunrise. And Rita, the album was nominated for Best Country Album for the 2010 Independent Music Awards. That must have been nice news when you heard that.
Yeah, it's great news. The Independent Music Awards are, I call them the poor man's Grammy. They're for for independent musicians who don't have big labels swinging behind them. So I was honored. It's actually an international competition. So I was honored to be one of five nominees.
Do you consider your album country?
I do. I consider it's, although when you compare it to the other folks on that list, it doesn't sound as maybe as country as a lot of people think. It's probably more of country folk. Yeah. It's a little softer and less kind of country.
Well, let's listen to another clip from the album. This song is Montgomery Creek Blues.
It happened again. I lost a good friend. And I can't see how things will change. On a night like the others, my cousins and my brothers were drinking out raising Cain. No surprise in the city, the things here pretty set.
Where's Montgomery Creek?
Montgomery Creek is the town that was about 10 miles down the hill from where I lived, and it's where I went to school and where we, you know, the mail came from. And when if you lived in Montgomery Creek, you were called a monkey cricker. It was not a nice thing to live there called a monkey cricker. It was, you were looked down upon a little bit because it was a very small town out in the hills and very poor, and a lot of my friends didn't quite make it out of there in one piece.
Your album was recorded in Austin, Texas. Your first two albums were recorded locally. Why did you decide to go to Austin to record?
Oh, I was very excited about using a producer, someone who could help me with song arrangements. And I found a wonderful man by the name of Rich Brotherton, who is the guitarist for Robert Earl Keen, and he's also produced some of Robert Earl Keen's records. And Robert Earl Keen's a Texas songwriter. And so I wanted to go there and use his studio and just take full advantage of what he had to offer.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Rita Hosking, singer, guitarist, songwriter. Her new album has Come Sunrise with the quartet Cousin Jack. They are Sean Feeder on banjo and dobro, Bill Dakin, upright bass, Andy Lentz, fiddle. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This Friday, Rita plays a house concert in Sacramento. Details at ritahosking.com. And that's Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Susan Morar. Technical director Mark Jones. Senior producer Jen Picard. A local rock band that had a couple of hits in the late 70s is releasing a retrospective of their work on vinyl. On the next Insight, you'll meet some members of Ozzy and hear some music. Also, Folsom sculptors Deanna Marsh and Judy Stickney open a new exhibit of their work called Brilliant Earth. And more sound advice from Friday Night at the Opera's Sean Bianco. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join us for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.